From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Well, the Florida legislature was all set to come back to Tallahassee next week and work on the budget. Then everything went boom!
Mr. President, I move the Senate refuse to concur in the House Amendment barcode 605877 and request the House to recede from the amendment.
Also this week, some bills affecting the welfare of young people actually made it through this year's Florida legislative session.
And I know that I'll be following up with DCF regularly for updates to see what's working, what's not.
We'll also get special access to a place where tariffs don't apply, and we'll even go dancing with a genuine PBS superstar. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. The Florida legislature's standoff over the budget and proposed tax reductions has gone even further off the rails. Lawmakers were expected to return to Tallahassee for more negotiations this coming Monday, but leaders in the House announced today they won't be moving forward after Senate leaders expressed reservations about passing the House's tax proposal. Tristan Wood tells us more.
It's been about a week since Florida's regular legislative session was supposed to conclude, but now House Speaker Daniel Perez says an end is nowhere in sight. That comes after he says Senate President Ben Albritton announced his chamber would not consider Perez's proposal to reduce sales tax by 0.75 cents. And all of that comes just today after Governor Ron DeSantis pledged to veto Perez's proposal if it came to his desk.
But I can tell you, any Florida last tax package is going to be dead on arrival. We are not going to kneecap our ability to provide you property tax relief just so we can give a little bit of a benefit to Canadian tourists. That is not going to happen, so you can take that to the bank.
The shutdown in negotiations could threaten one of Albritton's priorities, his rural renaissance package. The House had attached pieces of the measure aimed to bolster growth in rural communities onto a number of other bills. But the measure's sponsor, Tallahassee Republican Senator Corey Simon, decried the move on the Senate floor, saying the Senate wants its bill passed in full.
Mr. President, I move the Senate refuse to concur in the House Amendment barcode 605877 and request the House to recede from the amendment.
Perez says lawmakers will meet next Tuesday, but just to extend session to the end of June, or right until the deadline under Florida's Constitution that the legislature is legally required to pass a budget every year. Barry University political science professor Sean Foreman says he has never seen Florida's legislature operate in this level of disarray.
There are always hard negotiations as they work towards the final lines in the budget, but this seems to be more contentious than ever before. I don't recall a Florida legislature being this divided this late in the session. And again, it's all run by the same party, so that's remarkable.
The standoff largely centers on disagreements over tax relief. DeSantis wants to abolish property taxes. Perez wants to reduce sales tax with a plan to explore property tax reductions next session. And Albritton says he has long-term fiscal concerns about reducing taxes permanently as COVID-19 era federal dollars to the state are ending and questions remain about future federal funding. Foreman says in this debate, local government could be hit the hardest if taxes are reduced.
That whatever tax cut happens means that there's probably going to be pain for local governments, and they're already struggling to provide the services that they need with other constraints placed on them in recent years.
Lawmakers have until July 1st to pass the budget. Aside from the tax proposal, the House and the Senate are also about $4 billion apart in their budget asks. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida's 2025 legislative session saw forward motion on several children's issues, in part because Senate President Ben Albritton pushed for two sweeping measures that both passed. One is a comprehensive child protection bill, while the other is aimed at addressing the increasing prevalence of autism. We get more on that story from Margie Menzel.
The Senate's child protection bill was heard on the first day of session and finally passed on the last day. It would combat child sex trafficking by requiring the Department of Children and Families to collect more data about where children in state care are placed. It would require DCF to recruit people who have previously held public safety jobs, such as law enforcement officers and first responders, as case managers and child protective investigators. And it would establish a 4-year foster care pilot program for children with complex mental health needs, placing them with specially trained foster families. Vero Beach Republican Senator Aaron Grawl, the sponsor, has high hopes those children will do well with the extra support.
And I know that I'll be following up with DCF regularly for updates to see what's working, what's not, and how we make sure that these services are available to the children in the system in hopes that they don't repeat the cycle that has placed them in the system.
The measure has the support of Roy Miller, president of the American Children's Campaign. He's also touting another bill he says he's glad made it through the process. It's Stewart Republican Senator Gail Harrell's measure aimed at addressing the increasing prevalence of autism.
Harrell's bill with children with developmental disabilities, which extends early steps and makes allowances for children to be in that program longer, is another example of good policy making for children with developmental disabilities.
Harrell's bill is designed to increase early detection and intervention while filling in the gaps in educational opportunities. It lets kids with autism stay in the Early Steps program a year longer, until they're 4, so there's no gap before they're ready to start school. Miller credits advocates and families of people with developmental disabilities for helping to move the measure forward.
They were at almost every legislative delegation meeting back in their, their home bases. They had personal meetings with representatives and senators before they left their home base to come to Tallahassee. They were very visible at the Capitol. This was a very well-coordinated effort by the IDD community, and you got some good legislation as a result of that.
Miller's biggest disappointment this session is that a bill designed to expand dental care got caught up in negotiations between the House and Senate. He says Florida ranks last among U.S. states for the percentage of children who have had a dental health visit in the last 12 months.
So we passed it through the House and it went over to the Senate as part of the Rural Renaissance package. It didn't come back from the Senate approved, so we'll take a shot at it next year. Oral health in Florida is a public health emergency.
Meanwhile, one measure Miller is happy to see failed is the bill to expand child labor. He worries it would have hampered student success. I'm Margie Menzel.
Here's some more news from around Florida. Former Lieutenant Governor Jeanette Nunez, who was appointed interim president of Florida International University in February, is the sole finalist to become president of the Miami Bay School, according to the chairman of a search committee. Carlos Duarte, an FIU trustee who led the search committee, wrote in a message to the university community today that the committee selected 3 finalists, but 2 said they would only continue to a public phase of the process if they were chosen as the lone candidate. The trustees and the state university system's Board of Governors would have to approve hiring Nunez as president. Duarte's message said Nunez will take part in campus forums on May 21st, and the Board of Trustees will meet June 2nd to formally interview her. Arguing he has learned his lesson, Broward County Circuit Judge Gary Farmer, a former Senate Democratic leader, this week urged the Florida Supreme Court to reject a recommendation that he be immediately suspended after an investigative panel accused him of pervasive and extensive behavior demonstrating unfitness to hold office. Farmer was elected as a judge in Broward County's 17th Judicial Circuit in 2022 after 6 years in the Senate. He served as Senate Minority Leader during the 2021 legislative session, but was ousted after a vote of no confidence by fellow Democrats. And Florida Attorney General James Utmeyer's office this week filed a notice that's a first step in appealing a preliminary injunction that prohibits enforcement of part of a 2023 law aimed at cracking down on illegal immigration. The Farm Worker Association of Florida and individual plaintiffs challenged part of the law that threatens felony charges for people who transport into Florida immigrants who entered the United States in violation of law and have not been inspected by the federal government since his or her unlawful entry. U.S. District Judge Roy Altman last year granted a preliminary injunction blocking the part of the law from being enforced statewide. Still to come on Capitol Report, we undergo a strict security check and enter into a part of Florida that is not United States territory. It's also a place where the Trump administration's international tariffs do not apply.
The duties are only the local duties that would be paid in each market.
Federal cuts to art funding will hit hundreds of organizations in Florida alone. We'll take a look at one such entity in South Florida.
The last thing that I would ever want to do is to say no to a family because I don't have space or I don't have funding to put them in my program.
And a famous and much-loved PBS personality talks about how her dance-loving show came to be.
I saw me dressing in costume and playing instruments and dancing all over the world, and I said, I'm going to make a TV show.
How can a product be imported tariff-free to Florida without entering the U.S.? We have what's considered foreign soil in South Florida, at least as far as foreign trade is concerned, and we get more on that story from WLRN's Tom Hudson.
Among the warehouses that bump up against the Everglades, west of the Turnpike in Miami-Dade County, is a door. And on that door is a sign. And on that sign, between two Department of Homeland Security logos in red capital letters, is the word warning.
This is a sign that identifies the building as a foreign trade zone. And
walk through this door and you're leaving the United States as far as international trade is concerned.
You're actually exiting the commerce of the United States. You're entering a foreign territory. It's what it really means.
We don't need a passport or anything like that. To
get back in, you do.
Should have brought it. Let me put my vest on here. All right. Gary Goldfarb swipes his security card and opens the door.
To run a well-run business.
So as we step through the threshold, this is now a foreign trade zone.
You are now coming into foreign territory.
There it is.
And if you didn't bring your passport, you're going to have to stay here.
Goldfarb is the chief strategy officer of Interport. That's a logistics, warehousing, and distribution company. He's considered one of the area's experts on FTZs, foreign trade zones.
The important part of a foreign trade zone, and to understand the foreign trade zone, is the merchandise that arrives here has not, where it's going hasn't been determined yet, or what is happening to the merchandise hasn't been determined yet. All that you're doing here is you're in foreign territory before you make a determination.
The entire warehouse that sits on the edge of a limestone quarry is considered a foreign trade zone. There are pallets of tools, patio umbrellas, and toilets. Yeah, toilets, stacked more than 10 feet high. This stuff has been imported from India, Vietnam, and China. If it's headed to someplace in the United States, it is subject to President Donald Trump's new tariffs. If this warehouse is just a waypoint as it makes its way to another country, no tariff is due. Most of the stuff in this warehouse is bound for countries in the Caribbean, Central and South America, so no American tariff. That's the big benefit of these foreign trade zones, and some of the reason there are more than a dozen of them in Florida and more than 100 sites within those zones across South Florida.
Foreign trade zones are a tool.
It's as much a financing tool for a business as it is an actual logistics warehousing tool.
CFOs love this. Banks are saying, do I need now to have increased my lines of credit for my clients because now they have to pay duties, or can we do something else? And this something else, foreign trade fund, is that something else that helps most of the people that import product that never really had high duties don't have the lines of credit to support that business. So they're in trouble.
companies that would be facing enormous increases in their cost of goods destined for the U.S. market due to the Trump tariffs instead can have their stuff sit in a foreign trade zone tax-free before bringing it into the U.S. And the word into there is in air quotes. They can control their costs better by not having to pay tariffs until it leaves the foreign trade zone.
My name is Harry Bodan, a group general manager for Toyota Tsusho America. We are in the Parts and Accessories Center for Toyota Tsusho America, which is a central parts depot that feeds the Caribbean distributors Toyota parts.
This warehouse is just off I-95. Planes descend overhead as they land at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood Airport nearby. We're standing on a floor painted lime green. Ahead are rows and rows of shelves with all sorts of auto parts, from small screws to windshields and bumpers. And between is a small entrance. It's almost ceremonial-like. Printed prominently is the Japanese word "anzen," safety.
There's no taxes that are paid because it's a bonded facility. We can bring parts from different areas of the world, consolidate here, ship out, and the duties are only the local duties that would be paid in each market.
If a Toyota car or truck in Aruba, the Bahamas, or Jamaica needs a part, it probably came from this warehouse in Fort Lauderdale. But it was likely made somewhere in Asia. So it comes to this foreign trade zone, does not pay American taxes, and is shipped out to the Caribbean when it's needed. Jorge Hernandez is the business development director with Port Everglades, which is ultimately responsible for this foreign trade zone.
We see that many of the companies that have established themselves here have that distribution model where they're bringing their merchandise from all over the world and then doing distribution from Broward County.
It's a critical part for our operations and to ensure that the Toyota customers in the Caribbean and Latin America have a good ownership experience. It wouldn't be possible without that designation.
Foreign trade zones date back to the time of another trade war in the 1930s. They were created by a law 4 years after the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, which sparked its own trade war almost a century ago. Upwards of $25 billion worth of merchandise moves through Florida's foreign trade zones each year, making it a top four state for exports passing through. Even booze like French wine or Jamaican rum that's served onboard cruise ships can be brought in, sit in a foreign trade zone near Port Miami or Port Everglades, and then taken to a ship's lounge without paying U.S. taxes. Three of the top 15 zones nationwide are in South Florida, according to a 2023 report to Congress. It's a ranking certainly helped by South Florida's geography. And Gary Goldfarb, back at his warehouse in Dade County, thinks they give the region's economy an edge as new tariffs take hold.
We have all the tools necessary to help our clientele reduce the impact of tariffs as much as possible. And companies are flocking to Miami because Miami is that community that has all of that knowledge.
Back through the door with that warning sign on the other side. All right, we're heading back into the United States here.
Yeah, you're back in the United States.
Just like that. And we return. Fast.
Here we are.
This is already paid duty this fast.
No passports and no tariffs. I'm Tom Hudson.
1 week ago today, the Trump administration announced sweeping cuts to federal grant funding through the National Endowment for the Arts. And that came just hours after proposing to eliminate the agency altogether. Organizations across the country received emails that their funding would be cut. The Miami Music Project is one of them. They provide about 1,000 students a year with after-school tutoring and music lessons across seven areas of Miami-Dade County. WLRN's Julia Cooper spoke with the program's president and CEO, Anya Klimala, about the importance of art education and the potential impact to the arts community in South Florida.
So we give all the children instruments. We create ensembles in our 7 locations across Miami-Dade County. Really, the main goal is to give the kids a skill set that they can use thanks to a very intensive music training and then apply to anything that they want to do in life.
And so tell me about the history between Miami Music Project and the National Endowment for the Arts.
Yes, so Miami Music Project has been really blessed that we have been funded by the National Endowment of the Arts for the Arts for many, many, many years. For us, that funding has been an incredible source of not only pride, but also provides us with what I would call a philanthropic leverage, because NEA is a government national funding source. It's very competitive. So when you get that, we then tell, obviously, our other funders about it, and it helps us leverage other philanthropic dollars.
You recently learned that the project may lose NEA grant funding as part of the federal administration's mass cancellation of those grants. What kind of impact do you think that could have on your organization?
This year, we so far received 50% of our grant, and we are still waiting for additional 50%, which is the second installment. But for future, for next year, we are actually looking at losing 100% of the funding. A big chunk of money, which actually was specifically dedicated to paying for the fees of our teaching artists who directly work with the students and teach them how to play instruments. So that's what the grant was for. And also for our programming staff, for people who oversee the program or for every single location. So losing that funding will mean a lot, because that means that we now have to go out and raise additional money to be able to pay for the teachers and pay for the staff.
How important are community partnerships and local government support to your work, especially as federal funding becomes less reliable?
It is crucially important. And I want to be sure that I'm clear that I don't only speak for my organization. I am speaking for all the arts organizations, and specifically arts education organizations that work in our community. And there's many. And they do incredible work, and they provide the students with very, very life-changing, crucial programming. Most of the arts education organizations, including Miami Music Project, we don't have what's called earned revenue. You know, we don't have a concert hall that we sell tickets and people come and buy, and let's say 30% of our budget comes from that. We don't have that at all. All of our funding comes from philanthropy, from grants, from government support, from individuals. All of our programming is completely free of charge to the families and the children. They don't pay for any of it. It costs us $5,000 to educate one child per year. The last thing that I would ever want to do is to say no to a family because I don't have space or I don't have funding to put them in my program.
In your opinion, what do these cuts and the threat to eliminate the agency altogether mean for the future of the arts community more broadly in South Florida?
You know, arts really offer a crucial building block for the community. Arts provide compassion. Arts provide empathy. But also in our case, arts provide not only a safe space for the children, but also crucial skill development. And the skills that these kids develop in the programs, they have nothing to do with music, but they have everything to do with their success in the future life. It goes way beyond just having a good experience in a theater. It's a hands-on activity that teaches you a skill set that then in return makes you become a contributing member of society. You know, having NEA also says we care about this and it is important, so important that the government decides to also support that. And that's a very important statement for the entire society.
That was WLRN's Julia Cooper speaking with Anya Klimala with the Miami Music Project. If you've been keeping up with the Florida citrus situation, you have probably heard that it is in dire straits. But there could be some help on the way. Federal legislation would lower the required level of sugar in pasteurized orange juice from 10.5% to 10%. Supporters of the plan, known as the Defending Domestic Orange Juice Production Act, hope the change will make it easier for citrus growers in Florida to use more of their product and rely less on imported juice. The legislation has been co-introduced by U.S. Senator Ashley Moody. She says there wouldn't be a noticeable difference in taste or nutrition level if the change is made. She hopes the measure will give a boost to Florida's troubled citrus economy.
our citrus industry, both our growers and our distributors, they're really struggling. And until we can get a handle on this greening and this disease, we've got to make sure they are not in any way unduly burdened.
Florida's citrus industry has seen a 90% decline in production over the past three decades. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, as the host of the PBS series Bare Feet, Mikhail Malassi loves her job. She travels the world and has shared her love of dance in 45 countries so far. As season 7 begins, WGCU's Sandra Victorova caught up with Malassi to learn about her path and why everyone should include dance in their travel itinerary.
A dancer hosting a travel show, how did it happen?
I grew up dancing and making music as a kid. My nickname as a little kid was Tutto Pepe, which means all pepper. I come from a family of immigrants. And that was because I could never keep still. I was always dancing. And I grew up, I went to dance school starting at 3. I started playing musical instruments around the same time. And I was really lucky that my family cultivated the arts. I was the only person in my family that ever played instruments or danced, any of those things, but I had wonderful opportunities. Fast forward, I studied abroad in college and caught the travel bug. But then I worked in the music industry and I had stopped dancing for quite a while. And I had this sort of sense of missing dance. And dance came back into my life. I started taking classes again. But when I would travel, but I would use dance to connect with locals by the universal language of dance. So when I couldn't speak that local language, I'd be going to festivals or holidays or some sort of celebration in the streets, carnival, and I'd be dancing with folks. I had this weird skill of picking up dances very quickly. And so from there, it wasn't just the dance that I was learning. It was these friendships that I made. Fast forward to 2010, I was fast asleep and woke myself up having this aha moment. I literally saw a projection on the wall in front of me of what Bare Feet is today. I saw me dressing in costume and playing instruments and dancing all over the world, and I said, I'm gonna make a TV show. Had no production background, no hosting background, had never been on television. Wow. And I was like, I'm gonna do it. And here we are 15 years later, season 7.
Several Emmys,
Several Emmys, thank you, yeah. And it's been such a journey and such a joy to connect with the world. I don't consider myself a dancer. I don't. Labeling myself as a dancer, a lot of people would say, well, I'm not a dancer, so I can't do that. No, I want people to be inspired to try to step out of their comfort zone by maybe grabbing someone's hand respectfully and dancing with them or cooking with them or things that they love to do. So I like to say I'm a dancing traveler versus a traveling dancer.
So many of us love to travel, right?
Right?
And we always think of like food and the sights.
Right.
So you think we should actually incorporate dance in some way
when
we travel?
Gosh. Yes, 100%. Dance or whatever you like to do at home, do it while you're traveling. If you run marathons, go find the communities that they do marathons in other destinations around the world. If you love to cook, do that. If you love bird watching, if you love distilleries and breweries and want to go do tastings or wineries, if you find a passion that you have, and find the other community that has that same passion, you'll find that connection. I love to dance. I cannot keep my feet still. So I find communities and people that have that same passion for their own dances and their culture, and they see that I have this joy and love for it, and they share so much more of themselves with me because of that. I think that's the magic of Bare Feet.
That was Mikhail Malassi, host of Bare Feet on PBS. Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Julia Cooper and Sandra Victorova. Technical support for Capital Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week on air and online for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.